All right, class, we're back for another episode. This is Optimus Fields, and tonight we have a legendary presentation by our boy, Surfer Jim. Without further ado, we're at block height 702,792, and the current price per Bitcoin is 2,342 sats per dollar, which equals $42,701 per Bitcoin. So, guys, without further ado, we're going to give Jim the stage because we know he's going to have some epic Jim rant. So, Jim, introduce yourself. I mean, I'm sure people know who you are, but show your wares and then just jump right into it.
All right. Not much to show. I'm just a surfer who found Bitcoin a few years back and decided it's worth spending the rest of my life promoting. So I'm here to hopefully explain some things that I've uncovered and maybe teach some people and hopefully convince people that Bitcoin is inevitable. So I might as well just get started. Bitcoin is inevitable by Surfer Jim, and I can prove it. So in my attempt to prove it's inevitable, what do I mean by inevitable? I think it's inevitable in a whole bunch of different ways in this world. Obviously inevitable as money, because we know Bitcoin as money. So I think it will be the world's only money one day. I think that's inevitable. And that's one of the most important things about it. But there's a whole bunch of other things that happen if Bitcoin becomes the world's money, including reducing violence. I believe that incentives will change for all of humanity and that war will be a thing of history. The opposite of that is that, you know, it enhances peace between people in all different ways, I believe, and I see it in the Bitcoin community around me, the way people treat each other. It fixes society in general and people individually. Again, I see this in myself and in the people around me that I know in the Bitcoin community. They routinely say that they're changed, fundamentally changed as people to their core because they've aligned with Bitcoin and how that affects their outlook on the world and many other things. And I think this is another thing that's inevitable once people understand what Bitcoin is, that it fixes these things. I think it fixes the environment. We know in Bitcoin that Bitcoin doesn't waste energy. Bitcoin uses waste energy, and that helps clean up the world. We can get into a huge, long discussion about that, but as Bitcoiners, we think that Bitcoin is actually good for the environment, very good for the environment. I think it fixes governments. I think inevitably it will shrink governments. One of the things that Bitcoin does, we know that governments and central banks create money out of thin air, and they're destroying it right now by just printing in huge amounts. That's why we see massive inflation. And in all of human history, all fiat money, the money that we work with, goes to zero at some point. So there's no reason to believe the dollar won't, especially the way politicians are acting. And once the money is no good, the enforcers that give them the power, that enforce the words on paper that they put down, they'll defect. They won't stay loyal to the people who are giving them crappy money. And so once Bitcoin takes over as the world's money, the governments that pay in fiat currency won't have the power anymore because the people they pay won't accept that as their payment. Another potentially long discussion, but I think it's inevitable that Bitcoin fixes government. I also think it fixes banking as a direct result of it being money. Nobody gets to print any out of thin air like they do now, which is the most important thing. It's a fixed supply. We all know that. And it's issued based on protocol and an absolute schedule that's already known in advance. And so you lose the stuff we know as the Cantillon effect or Cantillon effect, where some people benefit from the money much more than others when it's created. And there's a whole bunch of downside to the way money is used in the banking system now. And once we have a limited supply, fixed amount like Bitcoin represents, the banking sector of our economy will improve dramatically, in my opinion. I think Bitcoin is inevitable that it will be shown to be the most important discovery in all of human history. And I say that because money, as a construct, something humans invented, has been the one thing that's allowed us to prosper for centuries now, because We don't have to barter. There's all kinds of background about the history of money. I don't need to get into it all here, but the idea that we were able to come up with a concept of money and then turn it into physical objects that we could use as money, money being something that we can store value in, that allowed us to prosper because we could specialize in things. We can get paid in what's known as the most saleable good, the one item that is saleable for every other item. So that with money, you can buy anything, and with anything, you can buy money. And so money is an important thing, but we invented it. It's not natural. And as a society, collectively, we agree that money is good to have, and we value it. And even though the value changes, we still have it as a, as an important concept and a construct that we use to get through society. And as it is so important to our growth in human society, the better the money, the more important that is. And so I see money as the most important invention that's allowed humans to prosper. And we now have the best form of that money in the form of Bitcoin. So to me, it will be considered the most important discovery in all of human history once it's ubiquitous across all of society, in my opinion. All right. So my path, I plan to describe how it's inevitable by showing a series of truths, I believe. First, physical truths, stuff that's in the natural world that's all around us. It's just not arguable. Then I want to show things that are partially physical, but that have a subjective nature to them. As I describe that stuff, it'll be more obvious what I mean. And then there are other things that are not physical at all, but they're obvious to our human condition. That is, things like truth and trust, trustworthiness, those kind of things. Then show some truths that are not physical at all, not as obvious, but ultimately provable. When you ask enough people, so things that are not physical like money, when you ask enough people about the properties of money or the use of money or the need for money, you can find a sort of a truth that permeates through all people regarding something that's not actually natural because we made it up, and that leads to Bitcoin as the best money we've ever seen. So let me go through. First, a little bit about my background. As a kid, growing up, I took everything apart. I needed to know how it worked inside, from things like my record player, my bicycle, the car, eventually the house. But that's how I came to understand Bitcoin. I took it apart technically. I learned about how it works, how the code functions, how the nodes around the world will function. And that was what I needed to understand Bitcoin. I spent at least 6 months before I could convince myself to buy any Bitcoin because I had to understand how it worked inside. So I come from a perspective of a lifetime of education and observation analysis, over five decades at this point, of me looking at the world through, like, you know, how things work. I was always curious about everything around me. Like, how does it work inside? If I push a button, what goes on inside to make something happen? So just part of my natural curiosity. I can remember back to getting my first toolbox and how excited I was. You know, I could now fix things. I was like Mr. Fix-It. I used to fix everything all around me. I could take something apart because I had some tools, but I could also fix things that I found inside were broken, which was really interesting to me. And I started just fixing everything in my life, which was great because I could save some money. But what I didn't realize was happening, I was learning first principles by observation. I was starting to see how things in the world around me worked. Like, why, when you push a button over here, does something on the other side of this gadget move? You know, like, there's springs, there's gears inside, all that stuff. That was like a whole new world to me. And I started to see, you know, if something was broken, I could say, oh, it popped out of its position. I see what's going on here. So that stuff was very fascinating to me. And so one of the things that I liked about first principles is you get down to the most basics, right? Like this slide shows it. You dig down deeper and deeper and deeper to find out exactly to the point of what's exactly happening. And so one of the things I learned about first principles, I learned this definition. First principles act on us regardless of our knowledge of them or our attitude towards them. And one of the most obvious ones in nature is something like gravity. So you don't have to know about gravity, but it's still going to act on you. It holds you to the earth. It makes things fall on your head when you're not looking, right? So gravity is going to act on you. Regardless of your knowledge of it. But you could know about gravity too and have a bad attitude about gravity and decide it doesn't affect you, walk off the top of a building and gravity's not going to care and you're going to see the results. So first principles of all kinds, they act on us regardless of our knowledge of them. So, you know, this is one of the things, you know, first principles are acting on people all day long. They just don't know it. And even sometimes when they know it, if they believe the wrong thing, they're going to see the results in that regard because of that. So I had to learn first principles as a kid growing up by working on stuff like the brakes on my bicycle. There's things like leverage that's going on here and friction. I worked on the lawnmower, figured out how it ran and how to cut the grass easiest, that, you know, if it had a good sharp blade and the chute wasn't clogged. All these things are part of, you know, like somebody invented a lawnmower, but it also works by a bunch of principles that have to come into play. You know, the spark plug in the engine has to be clean, and you know, the air filter, all these different things. So I had to learn all these things through trial and error. Well, I didn't have to, but I naturally didn't. I had to mow the lawn anyway, so it was my benefit to have it working well. Then to the car, you know, learn how to do my own tune-up or a brake job. All these things saved me money along the way. But I was learning how other engineers figured things out. First principles of the world, how to make a car actually stop and you can trust it every time. Most people don't know how brakes work inside of a car. The two pictures on the right are brakes. One is a rear drum brake, and the bottom picture is a typical front disc brake, although a lot of cars have all-wheel disc brakes. And they work differently, but in similar principles. And once you understand the principles, you can understand how the thing's actually functioning. So, like, again, like as a kid, I'm learning this stuff. One of the cool things my parents did for me is they bought me this model as a kid growing up. This is an actual V8 engine that when you push the button, batteries made the thing turn, and you could see spark plugs light up and camshaft and rocker arms moving. And like, I literally learned how a car engine worked by building this engine. And they were so thrilled. I was so thrilled, and they could see it. The next Christmas, they got me this chassis to put it on. And now I got to learn how a car worked, like the differential or the gearbox or the brakes. And all of this stuff, again, was just teaching me about the world around me and how first principles are acting on us and how engineers have learned about a bunch of things and then were able to design things that took advantage of the first principles of mechanics and gravity and friction and whatever else, and build things in the world around us. So from my earliest Erector set to where I could like build my own stuff to like this picture on the right, which is a kitchen we just remodeled. For those of you who don't know, I'm a contractor. I build and remodel homes. You know, all these first principles have served me really well. Like when you build a kitchen, you got to know a lot of first principles to get it to come out nice. Anyway, so I grew up in a world, you know, I'm getting up there in age compared to most people in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And so when I was growing up as a kid, there was not really any electronics. There was no internet, no computers, no cell phones, none of the stuff people have today. And so I grew up in a very mechanical world. I never really got deep into how electronics worked, even though there were some around me in my world. It was mostly a mechanical impression of things. And I started seeing things around me and started to understand these things. These are, again, more first principles that are in the world around us. So something like a lever, we've given these things titles. There's a point of effort, there's a point of resistance, there's a fulcrum, there's a direction of motion. But if you look at this picture, there's three different levers, three different ways to move an object with motion and effort and leverage and a fulcrum point. And we have figured out how to use this. Now, these are first principles of the world. They're here regardless of our knowledge of them or our attitude towards them. But we have figured out, okay, if we do it this way, look at the advantage we get. So us humans went around the world learning about first principles all around us by just noticing things and figuring this stuff out. So this is like levers are first principles of our planet. They have to do with gravity and motion and friction. And we don't get to choose them. Only we get to choose from them the one that might serve us best. But we don't get to choose that they work or don't work. They're part of this world. We have nothing to say about it, right? So this is one of these first principles. Pulleys work in a very similar way. They're a type of first principle. Now, we invented them, but they help us move objects using friction and leverage in different ways that allow us to do things and build our world around us. So again, humans figured out that if you run a rope through a wheel, you can move a weight in different ways easier than if you just try to pick it up with your hands or something. Again, first principles of gravity and friction and motion in the world around us that we've learned to figure out and then make use of. We found these first principles by looking at the world around us. We would apply forces to different materials to figure out things like breaking points. We would observe patterns in the world around us. From that, we could get statistics that could be extrapolated from those results. If you start writing down different things, you can see patterns. So this is us as humans, all throughout human history at all different levels in all parts of the world, looking at the world around them and figuring stuff out. We would then make predictions. Oh, what if I push this over here at this speed, at this height, this weight, whatever, what's going to happen? And by doing this, we make further and further observations. We add data to the existing information. We're able to produce statistical models. And then from that, this gets into math and the realm of statistics, which I'm far from an expert about, but something known as a standard deviation and a bell curve, which allows us to see how likely something is to happen. This is a really key concept. Everybody needs to... I'm going to refer back to this bell curve for a whole bunch of other truths. So we'll talk about this a little bit more. But we draw, from these observations, we can derive truths in physics and engineering by, again, measuring this, trying to replicate something, like do an experiment and have it and try to do it exactly the same every time and see, do the results come out the exact same every time? And so by doing that, we have figured out a whole bunch of stuff about this planet, and we've been able to be very successful in building homes that don't fall down on us and creating cars that get us from A to B and planes and boats that take us places all over the world. And all these inventions we've come up with because we've figured out the breaking point of objects and the stress points and the friction loads and all kinds of stuff. This is all very much first principles of the world around us that we have had to find, figure out, measure, and work with as best as possible. So the bell curve, right? This is not a lesson in statistics, but when we test as uniformly as possible, so as I was saying earlier, you want to try to replicate a test so that you can know that something is going to always work. And in the construction industry, I deal with steel beams and structural loads all the time. And so somebody has to figure out that if we're going to build this house and we need, we got a big open room, how are we going to span, the distance from one wall to the other? What size lumber do we need that will never break with the loads above it on the second floor? All that stuff is calculated, by people testing as uniformly as possible. We measure, we log the results as consistently as we can, and we find out how accurate the tests are and how accurately we can predict, whether something's going to fail or not fail. And then we could use it knowing it's going to be good. We look for averages and patterns in all the different types of tests we might run on anything that we're trying to figure out. And then we get this thing called the standard deviation, which is a measure of the amount of variation or dispersion of a set of values. So when you're testing something, I'll just throw out some numbers. You're going to break up a 2x4 in half. You got an 8-foot 2x4 suspended at each end, and you're going to put some weight in the middle. Let's say it takes 50 pounds to snap it in half. If you do that test again, it maybe takes 51 pounds, maybe it takes 49, maybe it takes 48, maybe it takes 56. You're like, wow, it's a little different for every 2x4. Holy crap. How far out from the first test does it go? Where's my average in the middle? How much can I trust the 2x4? What load should I really put it under so that it'll never fail? You do enough of these tests, you're going to get an average right in the middle, and you're going to see how far is the furthest one, the strongest one you could ever find, and the weakest one you could ever find. And that's your bell curve and your standard deviation. So like in the one standard deviation, either side of the mean average, you'll get 68% of your results if you're trying to replicate something. This is what, the statisticians have figured out. And then you go beyond that, another 16% will fall outside of that, towards the edges, and then a tiny percentage at the very, very margins. And so this measurement and this statistical evaluation, when you look at this in the physical real world where there's absolutes, we don't choose. We don't choose gravity. We don't choose Plumb level. We don't choose leverage or any of these stuff. We can only work with it. When you measure this stuff and it doesn't always measure exactly the same, even though the world hasn't changed, there's something that it has changed. Right, we don't know what it is. In a 2x4 example, it's the density of the wood, maybe, who knows? So you when you're measuring all this stuff around you and you're measuring the actual physical world and you're not trying to manipulate it, you come to realize that truth, even in the physical world, there's an absolute truth that the physical world wants to give you. But our ability to know what it is comes down to the granularity with which we can measure. How close and how tight do our measurements get? How uniform is the testing material that we're testing? The more tight we can make that stuff, the more we can find an absolute truth. Now, this is for stuff in the absolute physical world. Forget about it when it comes to the subjective world of people's opinions. But you can still, and this is where I'm leading, you can still find truth even when it's not as measurable as the physical world actually is. So let's move on. So finding first principles. So one of the first ones, I touched on it a few times already, gravity. You know, plumb and level is a really critical concept for us humans to wrap our heads around. So plumb is just a weight hanging from a string at any point on the earth. It's going to pull straight down, and that's going to show you what gravity is, where gravity is right where you happen to be on the earth. Then another first principle that we found on this earth, something called geometry, and what we use in construction all the time, a 3-4-5 triangle, that's, again, this is something that's on the earth. We had nothing to do with it. We found it, and we figured out what it does. I'll get to it in a minute. Another thing, wedges, which is a type of triangle in building. We call that an inclined plane. I'll touch on this. It's something, again, these are all first principles in the world. We don't get to choose these circles. We chopped them up into degrees up to 360, and there's a whole story behind that. But the concept of a circle is not something we created. It's a physical reality of our planet. Chemical experiments, when we found things on this earth and we started mixing them up, those things, they're going to react the way they're going to react. We don't choose that. That's another like first principle. We had to learn about what will happen when we mix different things on this planet. And we've tested a million different things, and we've benefited from all that testing, and we've used all kinds of different chemicals to help us, you know, prosper for in various ways. The plumb and level thing, we talked about, simple. The 3-4-5 triangle, if you take a line that's 3 units long on one side, another line that's 4 units long, and you touch two ends together, and then take another straight line that's 5 of the same units, when you connect the other two tips of the three unit line and the 4 unit line, you'll always create an inside corner that's 90 degrees. And so when you're trying to find plumb, you hang a weight from a string. When you're trying to find level, which is exactly 90 degrees to plumb, you need to do a 3-4-5 triangle. But by doing that, humans have been able to manufacture everything on this earth, because every factory on this earth and every machine in every factory has been plumbed and leveled so that measurements can be taken, so that products can be built. Think about your 3D printer and how critical it is to have the bed of that printer perfectly level before you try to make anything. So this principle of our planet, these two principles, plumb and level and 3-4-5 triangle, affect us all over the place. The inclined plane I talked about before is simply a triangle. And if you're trying to lift a weight up high, you have the resistance pushing down, your force is pushing forward. The more gradual that slope of that inclined plane, the easier it is to get that weight up to that higher height. And so we figured this out. This is a principle of the world around us. We could move heavy objects up high if we had an inclined plane. And people believe the pyramids might have been built this way. Something like a screw that we invented is simply an inclined plane that's wrapped around a shaft. And by doing that, it creates a whole bunch of friction with the bolt that would be put on that. And we were able to use, again, these physical first principles of the world around us to invent things that aligned with them, and bolts are everywhere. They hold all kinds of things together. I talked about the circle and how it's cut up into a whole bunch of degrees, and by doing that and standardizing it, we've been able to build all kinds of crazy structures by everybody agreeing that there's 360 degrees in a circle. Going back to chemical experiments, one of the things that I wanted to just touch on in the physical world, going back to how we can know what the truth is. Let's say you take, there's 3 ingredients in gunpowder, I forget what they are exactly, but when you mix them just right, you get an explosion that's an exact amount, and it will propel a bullet out of a gun or a cannon, ball out of a cannon, some distance. And if you can repeat that exactly over and over again, you can know that you're going to hit your target, let's say. But It's impossible to measure chemicals down to the molecule, right? So there's still, again, this gets down to the granularity with which you can measure. Where is truth? You can't measure every molecule. You can maybe weigh a certain amount and hope that your scale is accurate, and every time you weigh, it's always the same or as close as possible. So the reaction is, again, in that bell curve and in that standard deviation, that your reaction is determinable, that we're trying to find truth here. We're trying to find what we can depend on in this world around us, right? So in the physical world, where we've gone through, you know, centuries of testing stuff and refining our testing methods and our measurement methods so that we could get as close to absolute truth on the things that matter to us when we can. And this is what we've done as humans. We've gone through all of this. So we've taken these physical forces in the earth, things like compression and tension, and we've tested them, we've pushed on them all around to figure out where the limits are. We've figured out that if you build an arch, there's compression in all of these blocks going around the arch, and so that none of them falls through. They're all cut on a taper, and every tapered cut lands right in the middle of what would be the center of the circle. And all of that stuff is mathematically calculated, but if you put a load on top of this keystone, that'll get transferred all the way down to the base. And humans figured out how to make bridges out of this stuff, all because we noticed the first principles around us, we tested them, we figured out where the breaking points were, and we built within the limits. Something like tension, you know, if you're going to build something with a steel cable like a suspension bridge, you got to pull something apart till a breaking point, right? Something like that. Bending forces use compression and tension. Twisting forces use torsion. All this is just physical stuff in the world around us, something called shear forces that would try to slice something in half. And we've spent centuries figuring this stuff out, measuring it, and then some really smart people figured out how to write it down in math equations. I understand none of this stuff. But this is us cataloging the world around us, finding truth, writing it down in equations and saying to people, hey, you can count on this stuff. This, we've tested this so many times, we know this is how it works. All right. So as I said, we find these first truths the more granularly we measure, right? We've decided to use numbers, which are essentially perfect. More on that a little later down. But basically, we conducted enough experiments, logged the results, whether it's weights, lengths, temperatures, pressures, forces, all these different things. And that's what we've done as a society to be able to build skyscrapers and airliners and cruise ships and everything else. And surfboards. Surfboards are important. So what you, with all these measurements, again, you know, it goes back to the bell curve. You test everything, you find out where's your average in the middle and how far you go out from that for your safety margins, depending on what it is you're testing. But there are, we're now going to go from the physical truths to the somewhat physical, but now we're going to throw in a whole bunch of human subjectivity to that truth. And the first thing I'm going to touch on is imagery, right? So this is a picture I took, sunrise of January 1st, 2001, Fire Island Lighthouse to the left there. And one of the things I learned as a kid, I got into photography when I was 16. And I've been taking pictures ever since. I probably have hundreds of thousands between film and slide and now digital. But there was this thing I learned called the rule of thirds in photography. And it simply is that pictures that can be cut up like a tic-tac-toe board have some kind of a draw to them that people, you know, and maybe people looking at this picture right now don't think it's much. Maybe some people like it. I happen to think it's pretty cool. But it does meet the rule of thirds, which is you can cut it up like a tic-tac-toe board and go, oh, okay, I can see where the thirds kind of line up for this picture. And something about human nature, when you ask enough people, this is where the granularity with which you measure comes into play. How many people do you have to ask, and what is it about the picture you're asking them? But over enough people, photographers and photography schools and whatever, have come to figure out that this thing, when we take a picture and we line it up to create an image that fits into a tic-tac-toe board, more people seem to like it. For some freaking weird reason. Nobody really knows. It's somehow maybe coded into our human nature to be attracted to certain patterns in the world. Could go all the way back to our evolution of survival, having to notice things around us, whether it's smell or taste or sight or hear, you know, sound. So I didn't make up the rule of thirds. I learned about it in photography. It's out there. A lot of pictures will line up with it. Here's another one, one of my favorite surf spots. And you can draw a tic-tac-toe board if you want to. You can say, all right, kind of lines up. Another thing about photography is that there's something in repetition. People are drawn to this. You could kind of cut this image up into thirds as well if you really wanted to, at least top and bottom, horizontal thirds pretty easily. But there's a repetition to it that some people feel is, you know, attractive. And it's not just, certainly not necessarily even this picture, but lots of pictures have that quality. Anybody heard of Swan in this crowd? Yeah, I think we all know about Swan Bitcoin, one of the best places to get your Bitcoin. But I happened to see these swans sitting in a lake one day and took that picture. So anyway, more repetition. Another thing in photography, when you're taking black and white photos, it was figured out by people years ago that there's 10 shades between white and black. And a good black and white photo will capture all of them. This happens to be an Ansel Adams photo, and he also understood the rule of thirds. So these are things that are very subjective. So they're physical because we use our eyes and we need light to see, and we need them to see objects and imagery. But it's subjective in you don't have to agree with these rules. But when you ask enough people, you can create a bell curve and you can decide what is truth. So there are some sort of truths. But again, you know, when it's subjective, there's always going to be somebody that doesn't agree. You can go to something else like sound. Now, sound is another type of truth, but it's a little different than imagery in the sense that it's very precise. Sound waves are very measurable. Things like volume, pitch, tone, frequency, melody, harmony. There's something in music called octaves. There are chords and scales. All of these things are invented by humans, but all the different notes are very, very precise and can be measured very precise. And we've identified these things. We've measured them. We've cataloged them. We've figured out what works and what doesn't work. So just looking at sound waves, there's a wavelength, there's an amplitude, you know, how fast, how far, all these things are stuff that we looked at. And one of the things that I found interesting when I was doing some research, I came across some slow motion photography of a guy plucking a guitar string, and the narrator was saying how at a certain octave, when you pluck the guitar string and you film it, you can see how many vibrations you get per second or per minute. And then if you go one octave up, it vibrates exactly twice as fast. And if you go one octave down, it's exactly half as fast. So it turns out that sound is actually really precise, like math, which I found very fascinating. But as anybody knows, like you listen to music, not everybody likes the same music, and it's sound, but not everybody agrees on it, right? So there are certain there's a certain perfectness to sound in music that is universally enjoyable to a majority of those who hear it. Combinations of notes that resonate well together, which are known as consonants, versus those that do not sound well together, which is known as dissonance. So there are these things that people have figured out. When two notes that don't vibrate well together are put together, most people don't like it. But some people still might. Who the hell knows? It's subjective. When they do vibrate well together, known as consonants, more people tend to like it. And that's how composers and musicians have come up with songs that a majority of people will like, or at least a lot of people might like. And so sound is physical, but it's also somewhat subjective. But again, if you poll enough people, you're going to find that we start to agree on a whole bunch of parameters about sound. And you can put it on a bell curve and find your standard deviations and figure out what is truth, depending on how you want to define, you know, is something in tune or out of tune. You can say, well, in tune means X amount of megahertz per second or whatever that stands for. It's some measurement of sound. I know that. Anyway, so you say that's truth, and then you can measure and get to it. You see what I mean? So like you can decide on some of this stuff, and even though there's subjective quality to it, it becomes objective when you ask enough people. Next thing would be something like taste. Ask enough chefs and they'll tell you that certain stuff doesn't go well together. And I'm sure most people have experienced that. And so again, there's something in the chemicals in food that sometimes resonate really well together and sometimes don't. If you poll enough people on certain tastes, you can again figure out, you know, where does truth lie when it comes to combining certain things for the human palate. It might be a little more subjective than some of the others, but I still think that there Again, you know, you go to culinary school to learn certain things about how food works, just like I might go to engineering school to learn how steel beams work so I can design buildings. You're going to go to be a chef. Maybe you're going to go to learn how food works so that you can design new dishes for the, you know, five-star restaurant that's going to hire you because you're so good at it, right? So, you know, taste may be subjective, but there's some truths out there in the world. You know, I don't know how to find them in this realm at all, but I believe they're out there. So let's go into some truths that are totally non-physical. These are things that I believe we can recognize as humans, but we have to decide on them in our heads, like they're not out there in the real world. So you look at something like honesty or integrity or loyalty or trust or trustworthiness. Just think about honesty. You know it when you see it. You could prove it. You can verify it. It's a type of a first principle, right? It's I say the physical manifestation of a human-dependent concept. And what I mean by that is that we depend on honesty. And the physical manifestation of that in our human condition is something that we look for. We want people that are honest, and we look for them to act in what we consider an honest way, that they've said they're going to do something and then they follow through. And so like this is the concept of honesty is not physical other than, you know, maybe it needs to get carried out in the physical world, but it's a principle of our humanity. We can't survive if everybody's dishonest around us. Like you wouldn't know who to trust. Integrity is just another, you know, maybe a broader version of honesty. It's showing consistency. Or, you know, your commitment, you're accountable or responsible. You're also self-aware when you have integrity. Something like loyalty builds on that as well. It's, you know, like your faithfulness, which you know, is part of your integrity and your honesty. Loyalty has to do with love and predictability. Also, your accountability to others, you know, whether or not you can be counted on or you can count on others. It has to do with loyalty sometimes. And then something like trust, which I find is a really interesting concept. I learned that trust is the overlapping of character and competence. That is, you're going to trust somebody more when you trust them, their character as a person, that you think they're not a liar, but you're also wanting to look for a certain amount of level of competence in their knowledge that you also want to be able to trust. So that if somebody's really nice guy, but you know they're a total dum-dum about a subject, you're not going to trust their advice on that subject necessarily, no matter how nice they are. On the other side, you know, they could be really knowledgeable about a subject, and you could know that they're an expert in a certain field, but they're a total jerk, and you just don't like the person, and you know that he's lied to people right in front of you. So, like, can you really trust him? Because you can't trust his character. So trust and trustworthiness are found in the overlapping of character and competence in other people. And so that concept is really interesting, and it's not physical, and you can't really measure it. It's pretty much totally subjective, and yet we work with it every day in our lives. It's a part of our human condition, and to me, it's a first principle, and you don't get to choose it. You have to work with it. You have to figure it out, find it, no, find out how to measure it, find out how to notice it in and around your life. Honesty, integrity, loyalty, and trust. You got to figure this stuff out. We find it eventually when we observe enough people around us that uphold the definition of these first principles. When we see it happening around us and we see it happening regularly, we start to figure out who we can trust, who is actually honest, who actually has integrity. And it is part of our human nature. We need to know where the line is on these things, right? We've given them definitions, but they're part of our DNA. We don't get to choose them specifically because they're going to act on us. In non-honest people that we trust are going to screw our lives up. So first principles act on us regardless of our knowledge of them or our attitude towards them. So think about these as first principles. They're going to act on you anyway, right? And they're not measurable. They're not even in the physical world. They have to do with our perception of the world around us as human beings. So as you can see, we've gone from the provable physical world to this sort of provable subjective physical world to the non-physical world. But I still think all this stuff is provable. Then there's other non-natural truths that we've created, things like laws or the concept of the non-aggression principle, or that you shouldn't murder, or how about honoring your contract? It goes back to honesty and integrity and trustworthiness and all those things. But these are other non-natural concepts. Being responsible for your actions. If you break something, that maybe you should pay to fix it. You know, that's just an honorable thing. It goes back to, again, honesty, integrity, trust and trustworthiness and loyalty. And so they're, again, not physical, maybe not even measurable, but when we see them, when they're acting on us, we can feel them. And we as humans are stuck with these as part of our human nature, and we gotta work with them. So let's see. That leads us to the most obscure concept of all, which is money, right? So the concept or the construct, the idea of money, is something we literally invented out of thin air, right? We figured out after we were trying to trade with each other, if we could just use something in the middle. And then there's a whole history on the evolution of money, all the different forms it's taken, but it is literally something we made up. It has nothing specifically to do with honesty, although honesty has to be involved in money. So does integrity. So does the physical, whatever the physical thing that is the money. So there's a whole bunch of things for other first principles that act on money, but money as its own first principle is something we literally invented out of thin air. But once we figured out that it worked, we were able to take advantage of it, right? So we were able to divide our labor up. That is, everybody could specialize. And everybody that's into Bitcoin already knows this kind of stuff, so I'll go over it pretty quick. The division of labor was able to happen, so you could specialize in one thing, and then using money, get everything else you would want. Money is considered the most saleable good. I think I said this earlier, where with money, you can buy anything, and with anything, you can buy money. So money is in the middle of every trade, so that makes it really important. There is more net value on the earth because of money, because people were able to take more natural resources out of the ground, you can combine their labor with them and produce more things because they could specialize. Through the use of money, we were able to literally have more stuff on the planet for all of us. It's created more efficiency. It's given us more free time. It's created more safety around us, more comfort, more reach. Physically, we can go to further distances. Because money is on the planet, we've been able to create so many other things that gave us all these other benefits. This is why I say money is so important earlier on in this talk. So properties of a good money, we know all this stuff, having been in Bitcoin for a while: scarcity, fungibility, uniformity, verifiability, divisibility, portability, recognizability. We figured out that if we're going to use a physical object for money, the more of those features it had, the stronger of those features, the better it would be. Bitcoin has all of them in a digital form. It also now has what we call network effects, where enough people have adopted it around the world to secure its position as a potential item on the planet to be used as money. There are people right now that use Bitcoin as money, but most people do not. But it can function as money, and it will function as the best money. So that's the thing. You know, it has all the properties of a good money, but it's not yet fully adopted as that good money. But it can be, and I say it's inevitable that it will be, because it is the best form of that money. I'm reading my notes. Hold on. Good money, let's see, a good money, not of, so Bitcoin is a good money, not of nature. Sorry about that, guys. I remember what I wanted to say. So a good money is something that acts like a commodity. Like gold is a commodity, it comes out of the earth. You have to go dig it out. So there's some cost involved with producing it. A good money has some cost involved with it. So a good money acts like a commodity. Bitcoin has that feature built into it, even though it's a digital good. In the Bitcoin world, we call that unforgeable costliness. That is, you can't fake it. In order to create gold, you have to go dig it out of the ground. In order to create Bitcoin, you have to mine it using electricity, so you can't fake it. This is an important characteristic of money, and Bitcoin has it. So a better money would be something that's crucial to human prosperity. And I think Bitcoin is like a tuning fork. It aligns people through coordinated money, like a conductor aligning musicians through coordinating all their instruments around a tuning fork. I think Bitcoin can coordinate people and give us the thing we need. There's a purity here. So I'm gonna run through just some random pictures while I talk. Photos that I've taken over the years for your visual pleasure, if you like. Bitcoin is a better money, something crucial and fair to human prosperity. It acts like a commodity, except with properties that can be changed, right? So it acts like a commodity, as I said, like gold. It costs money to create, and there's certain other parameters around it. But we can change the properties. So there are these very unique characteristics, which if changed would destroy it. But luckily, that's not going to happen at this point, in my opinion, and the opinion of lots of people around the world, because of the network effects I mentioned before. Enough people have adopted the Bitcoin protocol at this point that to make a change, the entire network would have to agree. Things like the hard cap of 21 million, the absolute scarcity, that's not a natural concept. We agreed on it, but now that it's in the code, we're not going to change that because that makes it a really good money. So it's all right. So we created a thing, so it's made by man, but it's in alignment with man's nature. That is, we tried to program in, or at least Satoshi did, and all the people that have helped work on the code since, have tried to make sure that the properties of good money were as good as we could make them using the digital realm where Bitcoin resides, right? So the issuance schedule was something that was coded in. We all know that every 10 minutes when it first started, there were 50 new Bitcoin being issued, and that got cut in half, and that will keep getting cut in half every 210,000 blocks up until about 2140, when the last little piece of a Bitcoin will get issued. And so that was known and predictable within certain parameters, and it's literally finite. Now, that's something that is not natural. We actually gave this form of money some properties that other forms of money did not have. So it actually makes it a better form of money. So it was issued also in a very unique way, so that the first people who got the Bitcoin when it had no value were the people who believed it could be money and wanted to make it succeed. Enough people with the right ideology decided, let's give this thing a try before all the pariahs of the world just want to make profits off of owning and selling Bitcoin. There was other people that wanted to make it the world's money and change humanity. And the way it was issued allowed a lot of Bitcoin to get distributed into the hands of the true believers first. And again, totally not natural. So Satoshi programmed in some really good features that allowed this system to get bootstrapped and adopted in ways that something in nature wouldn't have, even though it has other properties that are like a commodity. So these certain things about the way Bitcoin works make it unique, but also make it better. Something that was put into the code, digital signatures, which proves your ownership to the network. Another unique feature that is not fakeable, right? The way public key, private key cryptography works is like, if you broadcast a transaction to the network with your digital signature, you show a public key. The network can do math on your transaction and know that you have the private key without you showing it to them. Somebody want to say something? I hear somebody in the background.
Weinikus, I need that mute button.
So again, this is something that humans added a feature to this money, which gives you ownership rights over it that nobody could take away, because you have the private key over a Bitcoin. You could prove to the network you have it, and nobody could ever get that private key. They can't guess it. They can't confiscate the Bitcoin. It's totally unique because of digital signatures. We also did something. I like to include myself. I'm just an observer and a proponent, but other smart people figured out that the sizes of the blocks in the blockchain, I'm not going to get into describing that whole thing, but they can't be too big, because if they're too big, it won't be scalable and it won't be inclusiveness enough for everybody. So there was a whole big war back in 2017 about the sizes of the blocks, and we got some splits in the network because of it, but Bitcoin prevailed with what we call, what the community would say are smaller blocks. But it allows, what happened is this unique feature allows everybody to participate. It's just, again, you'd have to do a little more research. It's a little beyond this talk, but we programmed in features that made it better for everybody. That was a really good thing that was done by smart people. Another thing, there's something called a hash. I say it's an unpredictable uniformity that's predictable, right? Hashes are this really interesting math. I was reading up on them. They're really hard to understand and technical. But the bottom line is, you can, you know, in the digital realm, you can take any string of digital data, run it through something called a hashing algorithm, and you will get an answer at the end, which is another digital, a digit, a really long digit in the binary realm. So it's a bunch of ones and zeros. And no matter how big the input, the output will be the same size every time. And so that is a really interesting feature. And by having the output, you can never guess the input. It's not backwards. You can't undo it backwards. So hashes are really unique. If you take the same information, hash it twice, it'll always be the same answer. 100 times, it'll always be the same answer. If you change one bit or byte, the answer will be not just a little different, but significantly different, that you could never guess what it would be. So hashes are really unique, and they're part of Bitcoin. They're used to help make the Bitcoin system work. And the number of hashes that are needed to get a block added to the blockchain has been figured out based on, this is such a crazy invention that was put in, but there's something known as a difficulty adjustment that happens every 2 weeks in Bitcoin, and it has to do with how fast people are guessing the answer to the SHA-256 hashing algorithm, which requires this hashes, which is like a big guessing game. Again, I'm not going to get into all the specifics, but what happens is this network, what it does is the people that are trying to add blocks to the network are running this hashing algorithm all, you know, millions of times per second all over the world, trying to get an answer that they can prove to the network. And the answer has to fit within certain parameters known as the difficulty adjustment. And the difficulty adjustment is something that the network does on its own. Like, there's nobody pushing a button to change the difficulty adjustment every 2 weeks. It happens because the time it takes to guess the answer to get a block added to the blockchain is a known amount of time from the last block in minutes and seconds. And the software remembers that, and the next block, and the next block, and then it averages out. And over 210,000 blocks, it says, wait a minute, they've been coming in way too fast. That means a lot of people are trying to guess, and they're getting the answers too fast. We need to make it harder so that everybody slows down. We only want the blocks to come every 10 minutes. And all of a sudden, the system just adjusts itself. It's amazing. And this is one of the most important features about Bitcoin. So humans have programmed into this money something that makes it completely fair to anybody in the world that wants to participate because of this constant readjusting that the network does to itself. It's really a fascinating thing. I know that description I just did not give it justice. So I encourage anybody to go out and learn about the difficulty adjustment in Bitcoin and how it works, and why it's so critical. But it is absolutely amazing feature programmed into this best money ever created on the earth. And it's one of these things that's going to make Bitcoin inevitable, because once people understand this, it's what a lot of us understand. We know how important Bitcoin is because we know about this unique invention that's in there, this difficulty adjustment. We know what that means to the economics of the system and how it makes it a fair playing field for everybody and how it changes human incentives. There's so many things tied to this. It's ridiculous. This is so critically important. And there was never a money in human history that had something like this. And now there is. Right. So this digital money has all these really cool, unique features. Right. So if you take one thing away from this, I want to point out another thing, another really important invention, which is proof of work, which is extrapolates on what I just said. So proof of work is the idea that you're going to prove that you spent electricity in order to get your block added to the blockchain. You're a miner. You have computers out there. You're in this race to guess this answer based on that difficulty adjustment. You want to prove to the network you found the right answer so that they'll accept your block as the next block in the blockchain, and they'll give you credit for the brand new Bitcoin that get issued for every block. But this the way this works is, again, the network has adjusted itself, the difficulty, the guess that you have to make. It's been adjusted outside of you. You don't get to decide what is the answer you're shooting for. The network tells you what the answer is. You have to take your blocks, you have to hash them together with something called a nonce, which you change thousands of times per second, until you get an answer that fits what the network is looking for. And then you tell the network you found it, and the network verifies it. Now, in order to have done that, you had to have spent electricity. There is no other way to do this. The system is built with computers that run on electricity. They're going to require a certain amount of guesses. And so the network can basically say, you must have spent X amount of terawatts of electricity or some, however that's measured. Bottom line is, this is proof that you did work. You're getting Bitcoin not for free. You're getting Bitcoin out of the system brand new because you did work, just like the guy who dug some gold out of the ground. This is what's known as unforgeable costliness. Bitcoin has this because it is tied to the real world through the use of electricity, through the hashing algorithm, SHA-256 hashing algorithm, and the amount of electricity it takes to mine a block onto the Bitcoin blockchain. So this thing called proof of work, again, a human invented concept added to the functionality of this digital money, is just one more thing that makes this the most best money humans have ever seen. And that, again, makes it super important. And again, I'm going to say that all of these things lead to it being inevitable. If you were to go back and once you find people that understand this stuff, and right now that's a small community of people around the world that are Bitcoin promoters and proponents, if you ask them questions around these concepts, you will find the truths of these concepts, not just the truths of how they work, but the truths of how we as humans perceive them and why we care or if we care about them. And these are the first principle truths about money and about this money that make it inevitable. Right? You can create a bell curve. You can do a study. You can ask a series of questions on any element of this. And you will find that it aligns. There's a type of purity here that defies nature because it's man-made and yet aligns with our nature. All right? It aligns with truth every 10 minutes. The system literally balances itself every 10 minutes. A system of items that are agreed upon, their locations and their ownerships, which gets into property rights, which is again, something that we as Bitcoiners recognize very, we're very aware of that. It's a natural desire, and it's natural desire for the outcome of our lives is to own and know that we own certain things. And the way Bitcoin works gives us property rights. There's a bunch of background noise again. Somebody want to say something?
Yeah, stainless scrubbies.
Hello.
Yeah.
That. Sorry, that's Hobo. Just ignore him. We're muting him.
Whatever. Okay, so Bitcoin aligns us with nature through its energy because it's really doing what it's really doing is storing our energy with no loss, and that improves who we are as a result. It lowers our time preferences, it emphasizes value over convenience, causes us to strive for freedom and property rights for all. Most of all, it teaches us responsibility, one of the most important natural lessons you can learn, and aligns with nature. And aligning with nature is what we're talking about here. So it aligns incentives to do those things that will allow it to survive. That is, the Bitcoin protocol is set up so that all the incentives will cause people to want this thing to stay going. It's green for the environment. The full node with the verification, the self-custody, things like multi-sig, it's all open source, it's backward compatible upgrades. All of these things that were built into it are things that are helping to keep it alive, that align incentives in the right way so that people won't kill it. So so I had said this once earlier in the past, that I think a Bitcoin is a tuning fork. So similar to how an orchestra can align to one note struck on a metal fork that will resonate at a known frequency, once all instruments tune to that note, they will harmonize. Beautiful music is more probable coming out of that orchestra. With one price system that can't be manipulated, everyone can get in sync and know that they will harmonize with anyone they encounter. And not just financially, but ideologically, because they know they're dealing with a system they can trust. They don't have to trust the other person. The likelihood of win-win outcomes in interpersonal relationships, both business and personal, is increased. And I believe beautiful results are much more probable. So remember that bell curve we talked about? Humanity's going to settle on this money because it's going to come to realize it aligns with so many other important things that allow us to enjoy life and get through this crazy world. So Bitcoin is inevitable. It's going to fix the world in more ways than you can ever imagine and hopefully bring peace to everybody. So let's help humanity get there as fast as possible so we can all benefit. And that is why I'm here. I don't think I said this in the beginning, but one of my goals here was to provide value to those people who spent their time to listen to me talk. I hope I've accomplished that. I hope I have not wasted your time. I don't never want to waste anybody's time. I think Bitcoin's the most important discovery in all of human history. And I think it's incumbent upon everybody to spread that word. I'm going to spend the rest of my life telling people about it. So if you've gotten anything about this, hopefully you've gotten my sincerity towards this whole thing, my belief in this. And if you don't believe me, don't trust me. Go out and verify what I've said. I think you'll find that I have not lied to you about any of this stuff. So join the crowd of woke people that understand that governments of the world have screwed us and they've created money that's messed us up, and we now have one that they don't get to control. So anybody that wants to find me, thank you for your time to listen. I appreciate it. You can get me on Twitter, SurferJimW, and anybody who's in Discord live chat that wants to ask questions, or YouTube, however you want to run it, Optimus. That's the end of my presentation. Thanks for letting me talk.
Beautiful, Jim. That was beautiful. I don't think we have questions. We have one by Moses. It might be slightly off topic, but we can end it on this one. So Moses says, question for Jim. What's your vision of the Citadel and where would you land it? Where would you send Stony to stack some rocks?
I can be more public about this now because a good friend of mine is already creating a community in Mexico, in Baja, that I'm going to be part of helping to build. And I'm pretty sure Stony is aware of it. Some other well-known Bitcoiners are aware of it. There's people all over the world now participating in this guy's project. He's got over 1,000 acres of land. He wants to turn into a community with a community center for the locals and teach people about Bitcoin and about being friendly to the environment, build everything sustainable, you know, like off-grid, sustainable, have our own farming, everything. And so for me, Mexico, and I think Stony is aware of this project. I'm not sure. But the guy who owns the property is going to donate the property to this project. He calls it Rancho San Satoshi. It's in southern Baja. And he made it public by discussing it in public. It was put out on a YouTube video that I saw today in my feed, but it was recorded a month or two ago at a conference in Mexico. So I haven't said anything publicly about it because I told him I wouldn't, and I'm not going to elaborate much more than that on it now, but I believe he's okay with knowing that, you know, the public knowing that it's going to happen now. And so I know one of his goals is to find Bitcoiners that believe they could bring value to helping build a community, whether it's, you know, how to, you know, you're a plumber, you know, or you're a landscape designer or whatever. Like, there's all kinds of need of different skills, you know, like somebody like Stony would be good, right? If we're going to build rock walls or something, or do excavating or something, you know, as a contractor myself building homes, the guy who owns the property approached me about it because he knows I could help build structures. So I plan to go down there and help work on it and probably move there one day. We'll see how it all unfolds. You know, the world's a crazy place right now with COVID and everything. So I have to see what happens.
Awesome, Jim. Well,
there's an audience. Look at that.
Thank you, Jim. As Hobo put in our chat, we love and appreciate you, Jim. So thank you very much for coming out and doing that. We hope that this gets people thinking from first principles, and they will come to understand that Bitcoin is inevitable and they should be stacking sats.
They should be.
Yeah. So awesome, Jim. I think we'll wrap it up here and we'll take it into Teacher's Lounge.
No problem.
Thanks for coming out, Jim. We love you. Yep. And we'll see you in the next episode.